CliffCentral.com.
Meg Records is a director. She's picked up a number of really, really interesting awards over the last couple of years. She's done amazing documentaries and feature films. Most recently at the Durban Film Festival, Tess will go on general release in South Africa in February 2017. This is actually an Afrikaans film.
It is Afrikaans, 70% Afrikaans, the dialogue.
That's amazing. You see, I immediately saw the title and I thought, oh, okay, this is going to be a South African movie, but it'll be English one, and it turns out to be Afrikaans.
It does mostly. I mean it was largely economic. TechNet came on board with a lot of funding, but I'm
good
thrilled
for them,
I'm
by
thrilled
the way.
Absolutely, yeah. Good for them. Wow, really a brave thing to fund, and I'm thrilled with it in Afrikaans. Christia Visser, the main actress, is lovely, and she speaks both fluently, but it's lovely to have her in her mother tongue, and I think it gives us a kind of edge which I like a lot.
Now, you've done a lot of interesting work, Meg, and I'm very pleased we're here to talk to you today, because I don't often get to talk to directors. Directors don't actually like to talk about these things. They like to get on with the business of making movies. Why I'm interested is because you've done such varied stuff, scripts for UNICEF, you've directed short films, you've put together the DVD you brought me this morning, 1994, The Bloody Miracle, which we'll talk about in a moment or two. Again, I'm just, as a history guy, this is right up my street.
Good.
but you're also, you know, academically qualified in these kinds of things. A lot of people learn on the trot if they can. It's a rare privilege, I suppose, to learn to do that. But you actually did a PhD in all of this in film studies.
Nobody
right?
usually knows that, and I don't go around advertising it because it's a bit of an anomaly. Like, why would
it
a filmmaker have a PhD? That's kind of weird.
It is, because there's so many people who fly by night or who get there on their talent alone. And then maybe they'll do the PhD afterwards. They'll get an honorary one if they've won a couple of Oscars and things. But it's rare to find someone who started there.
I think I was always a bit torn between theory and praxis. And so I kind of did the academic thing simultaneously to training as a filmmaker. And I was a very reluctant academic. I loved teaching. I taught at UCT for a long time as a lecturer there. And I loved it, but I was a reluctant academic. I really wanted to get my fingers dirty.
Yeah.
And
I would imagine
so I'm much happier as a filmmaker.
A lot of people probably want to go straight to the practical. Mm. But you did say you were torn, so there must have been some interest in the theory as well.
I am interested in it, very.
Do you spend a lot of time reading this kind of thing?
Not so much anymore. I used to. But I am interested in it, and I like to see what theorists are saying. But I wouldn't say I'm always up to date with what the most recent theory is, because filmmaking is such a demanding job in its own. You know, I was working at UCT, and I felt my life had become this triangle. I had two young children, and I was trying to be a filmmaker and trying to be an academic stroke teacher. And I was like, I could do any two things on this triangle, but three I can't, not properly. And the academia is what had to go, because it was the thing I felt the least passionate about, whereas being a filmmaker for me wasn't a question, that was a drive.
And you couldn't very well say, well, I've changed my mind about the motherhood thing.
No, exactly. I know what I want to, but exactly that I was stuck with.
But you also studied at London Film School.
Yeah, I was really lucky. I got a British Commonwealth scholarship, which was, I landed with my bum in the butter.
So what does that involve?
I was paid for in entirety to study there for 2 years. I mean, normally you need to be a millionaire to do this.
Yeah.
And they paid for me to live there. And I felt like I'd literally died and gone to heaven. You know, I always wanted to study film, but I grew up in the 80s and it was something geniuses overseas did.
Yeah.
I didn't actually know many working filmmakers. I really didn't, a couple of political documentary makers, but that was it.
And in London, you get to meet really, really important, successful, prestigious people too, right? I mean, I'm not saying we don't have them here, but it's on a different level. And then,
it
of course,
amazing.
If you were in America, it would be a different level again.
Yeah.
But in London...
Yeah, I used to spend my life, I had a free pass to the National Film Theatre, and I would be down there 3-4 times a week, going to live screenings with directors there, and I would just be there whenever I could be. And that was really my education. I actually was cinematically quite illiterate when I arrived, you know. I grew up at the time of cultural boycotts. I had huge gaps in my cultural education, so I was just playing catch-up big time. I don't know whether I ever did catch-up, but I was in heaven.
And there must have been interesting people in your classes.
Yeah, there were. Yeah, there were some.
Any names we'd know?
Mike Lee studied well ahead of my time. He was there, and he was a patron of the school, so I got to meet him. but no, not so much now. It was a very international place, so there are people who dispersed to all sorts of places. Oliver Hermanus, who I later taught at UCT, was there, but later than me. So he's a name that we should know, and who's an exciting person to watch.
I'm always curious, if you say you're going into the arts, and particularly into film, in this country, you get people raising their eyebrows, and they go, oh boy,
yeah.
I'll bet you that... you know, we're going to have to, if it's your parents, we're going to have to support this girl forever. Or if it's a family, friends, oh no, Meg's studying this. She's never going to end up having money to pay the bond and that kind of thing. Because it is such a difficult job, particularly in South Africa,
It is difficult. It's really hard. I just read an article by David Forbes last night, which was saying that the heart's being torn out of the South African film industry and just saying it's unsustainable. And it is hard. I mean, financially, we bonded a house to make this film. My husband, Paul Egan, also was one of the producers on it, and he luckily has a full-time job. Otherwise, we would not keep up those mortgage payments. So I'm really fortunate in that regard. It's horrible as a feminist to have to admit that. But yeah, it's unpredictable. And we had delays on some payments, and we literally maxed out everything. It was very scary. Sacrifice a lot, and then you think, why did I do that? I was like flipping insane.
But at the same time, if you care about something that much and you believe in it enough, it's the only thing you can do.
Exactly. That's how I feel. I feel like if there was, and when young people, I'm so sure when I say that, when young people come to me, I say, look, if there's anything else you'd prefer to be doing or think you might prefer to be doing, do the other thing. Because if you want to work as a filmmaker, especially independently in South Africa, only do that if you feel like you can't do anything else. And for me, it's a drive. It kind of keeps me sane. Well, I don't know what I'm saying, but it doesn't feel like a choice. It feels like a vocation. And I feel like you do give up financial security, you give up sanity, all those things. So you kind of have to do it. Yeah.
You said that you grew up during the cultural boycotts and all the rest. Yeah. So how did you even find yourself in this field? What were you exposed to that got you interested in all of this in the first place? It just seems such an odd, you know, such a strange choice for someone in South Africa at that time, particularly a woman, and particularly... where there isn't really a set career path ahead.
Yeah, I came to it very circuitously. I came from a family of teachers and preachers, mostly teachers. And it was assumed that I'd teach, and I took a teaching bursary when I went to university, and I studied fine art and English because those were things I could teach. And I loved films. Even when I was at studying Michaelis, I used to go to the lobby whenever I could, whenever I had two pennies rubbed together, and watch all sorts of stuff. I remember watching a whole retrospective of Van Hatzoch and actually meeting him. He was here for a while. And film was just this magical thing for me. I always wanted to study it. And then I went to Japan. I was actually paying back all my bursaries and undergrad loans and things. And I thought I would do a creative writing master's. And I went into this American Cultural Center to look at all these files of things to study. And I saw these things for film schools. And hit me. It was literally a Damascus moment. I was like, that's what I wanted to do. I was always fascinated by the marriage of words and images. And filmmaking just suddenly seemed to be the path. But it took me a long time to have realized that. And then I applied and got the scholarship for Commonwealth Scholarship. They sent me to London Film School. And then you start off by doing little things. I made things for Sesame Street. I made NGO films, educational things. And slowly, then I got to make a mini-series for SABC. That was the kind of first breakthrough, called Land of Thirst, which was ultra-low-budget period filmmaking. And then you finally got to make the feature documentary 1994, The Bloody Miracle. And that led on to Tess. So it was circuitous. I only started making films, you know, when I was 30. It wasn't something I kind of knew I wanted to do from age 5 or anything.
Was it a desire to tell stories?
Yes. A desire to tell stories and talk about things which are important to me.
Can we talk about 1994?
Sure.
The Bloody Miracle. You see, I went to the Apartheid Museum about 5 years ago, six years ago. And, you know, it's amazing how you forget. It's amazing how little you can remember of the detail of what we went through in this country in 1990 through to 1994.
What a torrid time.
Yeah. And I was a kid, so I can't really be too hard on myself. Mm. But as a history student, I should be harder on myself. I'd forgotten the Avia Beer stormed the World Trade Center. I had forgotten about Nelson and Winnie Mandela's very public divorce. Mm. I'd forgotten about the arguments over the constitution at Kadesa. I'd forgotten about some of the names of some of the people, Alfred and Zor, people like that, that, you know, to us now they're the names of municipalities or, you know, we don't really.
I think we have a kind of collective amnesia, actually.
Do you think so? Because it's, everybody talks about our history because it clearly they're trying to make it sound like it's the most important defining thing for who they are and what they are and where they come from. But I don't think they actually care. I think a lot of that is just virtue signaling or trying to be important or people trying to show that they, very often with white people, it's a very cursory thing. It's like, yes, but our history. I understand. It's almost as if, well, that's a very nice broad brush stroke to say.
It's cursory. It's not actually engaging with what really happened.
And for a lot of younger black people, they imagine that their struggles today are in some way equal to the struggles of then, which is also ridiculous.
It is ridiculous, yeah. I think that's why we felt that people were forgetting and that white people were often just in denial, which was this cursory kind of, oh, but history, yeah. And we wanted to make this film that focused on that very interesting time of transition, which is often also glossed over. It was like suddenly we had transformed into this rainbow nation and it was all easy and it was this miracle. And actually underneath this was this huge pain and upheaval. And we decided to focus not on the people who wanted the transition, but the people who actually resisted it, because we thought that that was where a lot of the conflict lay. So we interviewed a number of people who were resistant to apartheid ending. And it was a fascinating journey. We spent a whole weekend with the AWB at their reunion, I think it was their 60-year reunion. We interviewed Mangosuthu Buthelezi. We interviewed Constant Viljoen in Mpumalanga. And it was really interesting when the story started to come to life.
When did you do these interviews?
2013, mostly, early 2014, yeah. Interviewed President Zuma. He obviously was someone who was for the change, but we had looked at different perspectives on these stories. And
well,
it was
fascinating. You know, we forget also about the IFP ANC mess that was going on, the IFP being as duplicitous.
And the East Strand was a war zone. So we spent a lot of time in Tokoza and in KZN. We went, for example, to a little town called Mayekle where 18 school kids were mowed down in an IFP by an IFP hit squad. So there was a lot that happened. I mean, these events were daily. They were absolutely daily. And I think people also got disaster fatigue. There were so many assassinations in that year. There was so much that happened. So this kind of narrative, this grand narrative of this miraculous, peaceful, bloodless transition. Yes, look, it could have been a whole lot worse. We could have been plunged into full-scale civil war. But there was civil war happening in certain regions, and there was a huge amount of bloodshed that year.
Well, that's the part that we also like to forget, because we don't want to be reminded of the cost of where
we're
at.
Those birthing pains, exactly.
Sure, we'd much rather say, oh, you know, the Zuma government X, Y, and Z, and Pravin Gordhan's tax rates, and blah, 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 whatever it is.
Exactly.
And complain about state capture now. And of course, these things are important. But I just wish people took the trouble, and I'm as guilty as anyone else. I wish we all took the trouble of reviewing our history every now and then.
Mm,
not for the purposes of trying to make it suit your current arguments, but just for the fact of it.
We have to know where we've come from as well and how hard won this democracy was. For all its faults, it's so much better. And you hear that like scary thing, people sometimes saying, oh, but it was better under apartheid. My heart just sinks because it's just like, what the hell are you thinking? You're such cuck. Yes, we've got issues now, but we do have a democracy. We do have so much more in place. And we don't want to, the other thing is that it makes you realize how hard won it was, and we've got to be very careful with those things, very, very careful about protecting the Constitution, very, very careful. It makes it feel so precious to me.
Don't you get annoyed also with people who say that, you know, Mandela was a sellout, the whole Rainbow Nation idea was just nonsense?
That's become quite current and quite fashionable to say that now. I think, very annoyed, yeah.
I think the people who were saying it a year ago, the fallists, effectively, you know, these extreme left kind of reviewers of history. And by review, I mean actually going in and changing it to suit their own narrative now. I think a lot of those people have shut up recently because I think they've realized that the facts are just not on their side.
Mm.
But when you make a documentary like 1994, The Bloody Miracle, and you see what sacrifices were made by so many to get us through that transition or to even make a small difference in tiny communities all across this country. And you, when you're close to it, it makes it very difficult for you to be glib about people's contribution.
Exactly. You can't be glib. People's contributions were massive. People contributed with their lives, literally. And people died for this change. And we should never be glib. We should never forget.
When you put something like this together, is it difficult to not get emotionally involved yourself? I mean, you're interviewing the Avia Beer, who are clearly on the losing side of history.
Yeah. You can't not get emotionally involved. I'm always emotionally involved in my projects. But I think what was very important for me on that project, because I was interviewing a lot of people that I disagreed with, most of the people interviewed, I did not share their political views at all. It was to try and connect with them on some human level. I never lied to people. I never said, I'm coming in, I'm going to paint a glossy picture of you.
You're going to do a fluff piece.
Never. So people knew where we stood. But I found that even with people from the AWB, there's always something you can connect with. And it was the big challenge was to remain unjudgmental and to try and allow for a space where you could see things from their perspective for a moment and to allow for those perspectives, which I think is easier to do 20 years later, you know, in retrospect, it's easier to hear people's view and people's pain and people's fear. A lot of that resistance was driven by huge scale fear.
Yeah. And do you feel that they're still fearful?
You know what? I think most of the people we interviewed have really adapted a lot better than...
So then what are they complaining about?
Yeah, but people have adapted a lot better to the new South Africa than I would have anticipated or than they could have anticipated.
Yeah. Are there still people on the outside?
Yeah, there are still people on the outside.
And how hard is it to get these people to talk?
The really people, the people who are so far right-wing that they're off the stands... are just, they won't speak. They're too angry. They're too fearful.
They're still here. They're still living in this country. They pay tax. Yeah. They shop at shops with white and black people who are seemingly getting along reasonably well. They read the news.
Yeah.
They haven't been killed.
No, true.
They all thought they would be killed.
Yeah, but I think there's often this kind of, live almost in these kind of little white kind of enclaves and refuse to. Yes, they shop. Chops and they, but there's still a kind of lager mentality. But I think it's a tiny percentage. I really think these are outliers.
Of course they are. They can't be part of the general society because they would stick out like a sore thumb.
Yeah.
And people would put them in their place very quickly. Yeah. I think, again, they're on the wrong side of history. But when
these people are really crazy. I mean, we went to a, what was it called? The Museum of the Genocide Museum, somewhere to the east of Johannesburg. And we went in with a black sound recordist and these guys drove up in buckies and they actually fiddled with our car. We nearly died 5 minutes later. So it loosened some nuts and the shaft nearly fell off. And
oh my God.
Yeah, it was really, but these are the extreme.
You mentioned
all four wheels came off on the highway.
So, Jesus.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad you're all right.
They're like, what am I doing? Occupational hazards.
You went to the film. You didn't join Punto with Caesar. When you try to find common ground with them, where do you go? I mean, you're sitting opposite some guy from the Avia Beer Eestergaarde. What do you do?
You know what? We talk about family.
Yeah.
About kids. About human stuff. Yeah. Not politics, anything else, or how much you love your country. My husband's really good about talking about sport. He can talk about rugby and stuff.
I'm crap at that.
It doesn't work for me, but that's always sport's always good.
And people like Mangosuthu Buthelezi, do you get the impression from him that he's at all sorry about being so duplicitous during those years? Nothing.
I have to say, and I know I'm going on public here, but he's someone, most people I could make some human connection with, I could understand, but he is so denialist. We spoke to an elderly warlord who since died in Hammarsdal, and she said when they used to discuss violent tactics, he would excuse himself to go to the bathroom. And he just denied himself over and over and over again. And it's
weak.
And all the evidence is there. And that really made me angry. So that's someone for whom I, after this whole process, I don't have respect. And I'm happy to say that.
Yeah, sure. Constant Viljoen. I mean, we haven't heard or seen him in the South African society for a long, long time. What's he doing?
He's farming in the Mpumalanga near Pilgrim's Rest. And he's actually pretty committed to the new South Africa.
Really?
He's made peace with his twin brother, who I think was a DA member or something. And
right.
And who helped helped facilitate some of those negotiations with the ANC.
I mean, this is a guy who kind of led the armed, the armed wing of the National Party government.
Yeah, absolutely.
The wars in Angola
absolutely.
And South
Africa. He had the military capacity to really put the new South Africa in danger that year. And I think he had a genuine look. The cynical part of me says he couldn't. He realized he was on the wrong side of history, and it wouldn't work. But I think he also
could have done some damage.
Could have done some serious damage. He had a lot of support from the army, a lot of support from ex-military people. And I think if he'd really gone, I think that what happened with the whole invasion of the AWB into Botswana, that whole catastrophe, and there's a big segment in the documentary about that, made him realize that it would be chaos, it would lead to major civil war, and led him to kind of change into the electoral process.
That's fascinating. Yeah. All right, so let's just get back to the modern projects of yours. And by modern, I don't mean 2013 is a long time ago. and you can still see this documentary, right? Has it been flighted?
Yeah, it was on ENCA loads of times. It was on ETV. It got a lot of attention.
Yeah, I might have even seen it because it seems familiar to me. And I'm glad
I think the first of the two, it's also available as two episodes, and one of them is on YouTube even now.
Okay.
But it's out there, yeah.
Well, I mean, listen, people must pay for the damn thing. You can now get it.
I should not tell
you can get it on DVD too.
You can. It's on Take a Lot. It's on, yeah.
What about Tess? What's the story here with this?
Tess is a very different film. Very, very different. So, it's a fiction feature for one thing. It's based on Tracy Farron's novel Whiplash, which is a novel I read 5-6 years ago and just fell in love with. Yo, it's a gritty, punchy in the gut book about a sex worker in Cape Town. It's based on a lot of research that Tracy did about around decriminalization of sex work. She met a lot of sex workers, but it's a fictional account. And it tells of this young woman who is selling her body on the streets of Cape Town, and something huge happens in her life and it causes her to look back at her past and face some pretty nasty demons. And I became determined to make this as a movie. I just was so moved by Tess's predicament, but so under her skin, and I just wanted to tell this on the screen. So it was a long journey to raise the funding and get here, but it's here. Yeah, it's going out tomorrow, 24th of April of February.
Okay.
On 20 cinemas around the country. And the other great thing that's happened this week is we've confirmed international distribution with the Little Film Company, which also distributed Tootsie.
Congratulations.
So that is just over the moon because it's hard to get there. And
wow.
So that feels really
You think there might be an award in this?
I hope so. That would always be nice. Yeah.
Sure. With Tess and the sex worker part of the story, I mean, do you have any strong opinions on this before you got involved in it, before you read the book?
About sex workers?
Yeah, because there are a lot of people who have just, for some inexplicable reason, very concerned with marshalling other people's lives. And then there are others who don't care and think that actually if we just legalized this stuff, these women might have protection.
My personal position is to legalize it and allow women protection. Yeah. That's not the view of all the NGOs I've met with. But I feel like it's going to happen anyway.
And then
sex work's never going to go away. And these women have far more chance at protection if it's legal and it's done in the open.
And you meet two kinds of feminists too.
Yeah,
you meet feminists who say to you, well, these women are independent, they're making a living, they're allowed to use their body as their source of income if they feel that that's necessary or if it's all they've got. And then there are the others who say, well, it's just straightforward exploitation.
I think I'm actually a little bit of a fence-sitter. I do naturally gravitate towards the decriminalization camp. I think that will give a better deal for women doing it. But at the same time, I find it hard to take the hardline approach that this is just an economic transaction. I think there is always a certain amount of violation that takes place. So I'm all for programs which can also help to give choices.
But you've already won awards for this.
Yeah, I know we have. It's been really well received up till now. It's done well on the festival circuit and it's had really, really nice reviews. Of course, it goes out to the broad public tomorrow and then you face your toughest critics.
Do you think so? Are people critical or is it more a question of you're just getting them to see it is the challenge.
That's the big challenge. Bums on seats.
Now, once they've seen it, they'll definitely have an opinion and they'll probably be pleased that they did.
But
actually talking, coaxing people into that cinema is the hard work, right?
Yeah, you know, it's not an easy popcorn movie to sell. So what I think needs to be sold on is the fact that Christia Fiss's performance is riveting. I really have to say this, and I can say it without feeling boastful because it's her. She does such a courageous performance. It's not like another performance I've actually seen in South African features. She just goes there. She's natural. You get under her skin. She gives it everything. And I think just for her performance, it's worth watching. The cinematography is fantastic. Bert Heitzman's images are really refreshing. It's got a great soundtrack. So I think there are all sorts of reasons to see it, even though it's a tough watch. I can't lie to people and say, you know, it's easy. Use the word glib earlier. It's anything but glib. It puts you right in there. You walk in her boots.
Meg, when you're a director, what are you looking for in actors? What I mean, it's always up to the director. You know, the director's the one who's in the end going to get the credit or get the blame.
Absolutely. I look for empathy. I look for flexibility. I look for the ability to be brave. I mean, we also worked with Brendan Daniels, who is just, to my mind, also one of the best actors working in South Africa. And I loved the fact that, his first take would be great. He's just good. He performs. And then because he's so good, immediately you can try something completely different. And that's so magical when you get that kind of alchemy when you're shooting. You know, I remember shooting this one scene with him and Christia, who have just such a chemistry, explosive chemistry on screen, and saying, that was good. Now imagine that she's your sister in this next one. And then the magic starts happening. And he'd go look at you and say, weird, but okay, interesting. Let me try it out. He's always willing to try. And so I look for that flexibility, that ability to play, that ability to empathize with the character, and also naturalism. A lot of South African acting for me is very soapy and very TV-ish. And it's hard sometimes to break out of that. Or because a lot of people come through theatre, it's very theatrical. So you need actors who can just be. Often the camera will just pick up an actor's thoughts. I spend a lot of my time saying less. Just think it. Just think it. Don't act it. Just think it.
It must be quite a fun thing to be a director, but it can also probably be very frustrating, right?
Sure. Maybe, but I don't find that part frustrating. I love working with actors. I love working on stage.
Okay, but then
for me, that's where the joy happens.
You have practical considerations.
Yeah,
you know,
sure.
It's a rainy day rather than a sunny day, and there's just nothing you can do about that.
No, I mean, that's the cut part. I remember one day, so we're filming on a tight budget, right? We've got 24 days to shoot a feature, which, I mean, in Hollywood would just be a joke. So you on every day is like the sword of Damocles is hanging over you, and that clock is just going tick, 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 tick. And we had a substantial script, and I remember every time I would walk onto set, the line producer would be, cut scenes! Have you cut scenes yet? Cut scenes! And so there's this constant sense of the whole 24 days time just going. And this one day we were going to film this clinic scene in Masipumalela township in Cape Town. And we had to be there at 5 in the morning or whatever it was. And we got there and there's a huge, massive, it's the time of the protest delivery strikes. And there's this massive fire right across the road. It's barricaded. There's stones being thrown. And the clinic we were going to film is just the other side. And there's no way we can go across. It's impossible. So the assistant director and I looked at the schedule and we're like, okay, we'll shoot one of tomorrow's scenes. And it's a Friday now. We specifically scheduled tomorrow's scenes for tomorrow because there's no building works happening.
Oh.
So when we get there, they're building works, so we can't do that. So then we head down to the beach to try and film something else, but it's a blue tide. So there's a leap tide. It's a blue moon. So there's a leap tide. So then we film something else quick. We kind of tick something off and then we decide to film this big scene. We're going to relocate it somewhere a little bit back from the beachfront where the tide hopefully won't wash us away.
My God. And
we film
and this
half,
is all in one day?
All in one day. We film half the scene and it's going pretty well and it starts to rain. So then your light completely changes. So it's a complete F up of a day. It's a disaster. It's like we've now lost all those precious hours and we're never going to make up the time. And I kept thinking, when are we going to film that clinic scene? And days go by and it becomes clear that in the schedule, we're never going to get that clinic scene back. So I'm sitting in bed at midnight with my double whiskey thinking, what are we going to do? And it's like, you know what? Tess isn't going to find out she's pregnant at the clinic. She's going to wee on a stick. and she's going to find out that way. We're going to do it all visually, no dialogue. And we have the next morning, the assistant director's driving off to his pregnant sister to get the pregnant wee that we can dip the dipstick in. You know, so it's that kind of organic process. So that part is frustrating, but it also is actually quite creative to work within boundaries and just think, I've got to make this work. I'm not going to get another day of shooting. I'm not even going to get an extra 2 hours of shooting because there's no money to pay overtime. Wouldn't so how do we
love,
make it work?
Wouldn't you love to not have those concerns, to be able to focus on the craft with the budgets that they have in Hollywood?
Of course, it would be divine. I mean, I also sometimes get a bit, when I hear what those budgets are, and they're like craft budget for tea and coffee is like equal to our entire budget. Yeah. And you actually just feel ill because you also know there's something that also feels wasteful and unenvironmental, and a kind of prudish part of me thinks, no, that's ridiculous. But I'd love to, of course you always want to work on a big budget. I think I always want more time. I just want more time. More time and not to make
it's
all those
so
compromises.
Pressurized, right?
Yeah. But at the same time, I look around and I think, I felt so bad that I felt so frustrated on that day of the service delivery strikes. I felt guilty because here I'm worrying about a film. It's a film. It's saving lives, you know? And here people who are dying of poverty. And it's just like you've also got to get things in perspective.
Well, yeah. I mean, I had this conversation with someone earlier and explained why I feel that the arts are hugely important.
They are hugely important.
They outweigh their actual material contribution.
The material contribution is what makes it tricky. The economics of it don't make sense, but you need it for all sorts of other reasons about
the
national identity and reflection.
Sure, but the movie business is damn hard, even in America.
Yeah, no, exactly. It's also very easy to say, oh, the grass is greener and it would all be easy if I was in LA or whatever. It's hard.
And even if
it's a tiny little echelon who working with a big budget.
Yeah, and then you make a great movie, and then if you don't make another great movie, you're a failure.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's you're
like
only
you're
as
never
good as your last work. Yeah,
right. Isn't that awful? That's terrible.
You know what?
Soul destroyed.
It's that... I always think that if I was happy with my movie, I wouldn't bother to make the next one. There's always a thing of, like, I could have done better, this could have been better. That also drives you to keep on being creative and keep pushing. So,
do we have enough good people in terms of crew in South Africa? Do we have
crews
enough?
Are really good. Crews are really, really good.
Good camera people, good lighting people, good sound people.
You know what? I have no complaints. I always feel like slightly awed by my crews because I mean, I only direct a film every now and again. So I'm not like on set constantly. And wow. I mean, I think there we are spoiled because in Cape Town, we have a very abundant servicing industry. So people are used to working at international standards. And crews are very committed. I mean, those people work hard. They get up 4 o'clock in the morning, day after day after day. People think the film industry is glamorous, but it's anything but.
Come on.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's what you described just now. Service delivery protests, changing direction, going to the beach, starts raining.
Yeah.
It's not fun. actors, actresses, do we have enough good ones?
We've got some really, really good ones. I mean, I just sometimes am sad that people are mostly working in soaps.
It's regular income, right?
It's regular income. We all need that regular income, but it's a very different mode. So I think... it's not that there's a shortage of actors. It's sometimes that you have to make a real genre switch, and that's easier for some people than others. I think some people can do it and some people can't. Yeah.
And TV stuff is obviously, you know, it's catching up to movies internationally.
Internationally, definitely.
I mean,
internationally,
if you had the choice of being in a feature film now or a TV series, 13-part TV series.
Oh, I'd love to do a 30-part TV
Wouldn't it
series.
Be something?
That would be amazing. Just to have that space, a canvas to develop characters.
Have you not got stuff sitting on your desk that you're just waiting for the right occasion to plug in?
Maybe. Yeah. So the next one we're doing is an adaptation of Borderlines, which is a novel by Michaela Wrong. She's an English author, half Italian, half English, and it's set in the Horn of Africa. And that's a big scope.
Somalia, sure.
It's fictionalized, but it's actually Eritrea and Ethiopia. It's all about that border dispute. Yeah. A very hot, hot part of the world. I mean, Somalia's a hard place
Would
to be
you
right
film
now.
It there or?
We'd like to if we can find somewhere that's safe. I mean, Eritrea is no-go. It's a police state. Somalia, maybe the area, specifically Somaliland, might be a bit safer than Somalia itself. But, yeah. Oh, my mom doesn't want me to go.
Rightly so. She's smart. I'll tell you to stop with this nonsense.
But that's an exciting thing. That's a kind of broader canvas. And that could possibly be a series. There's a lot of material there, yeah.
I mean, a series, a feature film, a documentary, a 13-part TV show. There are lots of different ways, different formats that people are using at the moment.
Yeah. I think the best writing is happening in TV.
Do you?
At the moment, yeah. I think a lot of the best writers. I think people who would have gone into novels in the 1930s or 40s are doing the TV series now.
Yeah. You're having fun, though.
I love it. I love it.
You wouldn't do anything else?
Nope. There are months when there's like no money left in the account. I'm just like, why did I leave academia? What was I thinking? But no, I'm happy.
I'm happy too, because I think we all benefit from the contribution that you're making with films like Tess to the kind of patchwork quilt of South Africa. And quite apart from making a contribution in terms of art, in terms of history, and in terms of our information, things like 1994, those are really important. You must realize that that's a material contribution.
I like to think so.
No, it really is.
On the good days. Thanks, Gareth.
Well, thank you. Thank you for coming to speak to us. All the best with making more amazing movies, more amazing shows.
Thanks, Gareth. Thanks very much.
I hope that we see your name in lights. One day we will actually pay attention to that part of the Oscars we normally don't do when it's you that goes up there. Wouldn't that be something?
That would be amazing.
It's not impossible, right?
I hope people go and see Tess. Yeah.
Yeah. Go and see the movie, you lazy sacks of shit. Come on. Get out there and see the movie. It's on from the 24th of February 2017, and you can book at cinemas countrywide.
Yeah, it's showing in mostly Stuck, of course, but a couple of new metros as well, and a few independents.
Good. Distribution. Very important. Thank you, Meg.
Thanks,
Meg
Gareth.
Rickards, the director of Tess, among other amazing things, just to catch up with her and to see what other things that she's done, and many of them really worthy of long discussions all on their own. But an incredible story, this. And Tess, a movie that we've all got to go and see. Thank you very much. CliffCentral.com.